The title of your talk on Monday is Aesthetic Inequality and Political Seriousness. Can you tell me just a little bit about this idea of political seriousness and what that means for you?
Sure. I'm asking the question, I guess, in a particular way, right? What does it mean to be politically serious? For example, I think when we look at a lot of right-wing media, those of us on the left, I think when we look at things that we see on Fox News, we are inclined to say that these people are not being very politically serious. Now, for me, you know, from the point of view of the left, it seems political theorists run the risk of entering the same territory, right? So, for example, it's really in vogue now among really prominent political theorists to really want to revisit communism on the basis of some notion of equality that I think hasn't really been thought through all that well. Derrida, I think, pinpointed this paradox that exists in democracy that I think one has to take seriously, which for me means actually just trying to figure out how we reconcile singularity with maybe not so much an idea of equality, but some notion of equivalence. And so I think once we can reach that point, we'll know that we've been acting in a politically serious way, because otherwise, if we just think that we're operating on this wish for some notion of absolute equality, we're not taking seriously the ramifications of that.
How do you see the relationship between political seriousness and art, especially film in your case?
Political seriousness, if we're going to achieve something that we currently don't have, we have to be inspired to do it, right? So there has to be an appeal that we're drawn to. And it seems to me that aesthetics is an interesting way in. I always come back to the example of the 2008 election of Obama. I think part of Obama's success and his appeal was entirely aesthetic. And I mean that in a genuine and important way, which is that he really understood how to articulate what had gone missing in American life. And his speeches were incredibly moving, right? Because they were highly aesthetic. When I say aesthetics, I don't mean just the art that one might find at the Louvre, right? I don't mean to rely on traditional notions of beauty, but to think of aesthetics, as another philosopher, Christoph Menke, thinks of it as force. I mean, if you think about what is a film is a particular comportment to reality. So basically, a filmmaker opens a camera on the world and shows these people in these places, but doesn't just open up the camera in one place. The filmmaker will take shots from all over. So there's always something constructive and constructivist about filmmaking insofar as it draws from the world and reorganizes the world or shows us things in the world that we can't see merely by opening our eyes and standing in one place. So that's an aesthetic element, right? And that's what politics does. That's what a good politician will do, is to describe the social in ways that are convincing.
And something that you discuss is the sort of classical narrative that most popular cinema follows, which is this three-act kind of play. Can you describe a little bit how this narrative takes shape and what it's trying to sort of ameliorate?
Traditionally, avant-garde aesthetics and avant-garde film theorists have regarded classical narrative as something that's sort of stultifying and productive only of fantasies that bear no relation to the social, and they rely on the sort of Aristotelian notions of catharsis. There's a problem that's introduced, right? We have this conflict between two people. The conflict is enlarged, and then each person in conflict finds some way to compromise and to de-emphasize some aspect of themselves such that there's a resolution, right? So I would say that those who are skeptical of classical narrative and that typically articulate a kind of avant-garde counterproposal to that have wanted to say, okay, this is just a fantasy of reconciliation that never really happens in life. And so the alternative to that in the history of modernist aesthetics has been to privilege a notion of autonomy. It's a continuation of Walden, right, in some respects, right, that the only way for emancipation is to exist outside of the social entirely. That's a view I reject, because I don't think we need an avant-garde aesthetic of emancipation if the only way to emancipation means no relationality whatsoever, right? I love avant-garde work. I champion it. But I don't see it in opposition to classical narrative, because I think what classical narrative shows us precisely is the value of compromise.
And you used in your essay on compromises the example of the house bunny. Maybe in order to sort of simplify a lot of these philosophical ideas, if you can describe it in the context of that film.
I mean, it's a film that I think one doesn't take very seriously, even though I think it could be taken seriously. It's about a Playboy bunny who's gone awry, right? She's kicked out of this house where she's lived, right, with a bunch of other women, and she finds herself homeless, right? And so she's walking through town, and she happens to be in a college campus, and she finds herself at a sorority, and she thinks this social formation looks like that social formation. It's a house full of women. These young women meet her, and it's a disenfranchised group. So it's the so-called ugly, nerdy girls. They find a way to adjust institutional policy such that Anna Faris's character, this former Playboy bunny, can become the house mother. And what happens, of course, is that they teach Stax Playboy Bunny to be smarter and thereby to be more self-sufficient. And she teaches them alternatively, right, how to dress in a different way, to have more self-confidence so that they can enter in the world in another register. It's not that these values themselves have to be promoted, but what you're seeing at a structural level, right, is a question of compromise. So in that sense, this popular Hollywood film, I think, which for some reason we regard as unseriousness, is quite interesting insofar as it enacts an important social logic, right? In the same way that I think this is what Obama did when he was elected. And this is one of the things that I think people don't like about Obama, is that they merely accuse him of being centrist. Let's say the kind of extreme left, you know, the autonomous left, wants to say, okay, well, he's always compromising. He's talking to Republicans. He's taking them into his cabinet. But I think at first, I think he was quite smart, because what he realized was that you couldn't just sustain a legitimate government on the basis of constant antagonism, right? So hence the idea of the Purple Campaign, right? Now, of course, what are the problems that we have in Congress now is that the right will absolutely not compromise. They want what they want to a suicidal degree. They're not afraid to shut down government because they don't want to compromise on their principles. And you can see it. I mean, there's a number of reasons why I think this happens. You know, the very idea of social media, for example. You know, everybody likes to say that all forms of social media produce togetherness, but I actually think it just produces isolation. If you think about internet culture as opposed to an older notion of broadcast television, right, where we're all watching a lot of the same things at the same time, well, now we get to pick every single thing that we want, and so we pick things that only agree with us. If the far right is only watching, you know, Fox News, and if the left's only watching MSNBC, we're not talking about the same things anymore, right? And so the disagreements that we have are no longer productive, because the disagreements just produce a kind of sheltered existence in which we try to find others who already agree with us. And so there is no sense of a common good. I think that we just have to find ways in ourselves to open our minds a bit again and, you know, check in on Fox News, not because you think it's going to be appealing necessarily, but you have to know what's being said. Or read a book that you don't think that you would like. Better would be to find a way to speak a language so that we can sustain a conversation, so that we have the opportunity actually to get them to compromise something, which means we might have to compromise our righteousness, right? We might have to compromise our desire to speak in moral terms and say, you're absolutely wrong, this is absolutely wrong. Even if we believe it, and even if that's true, you know, nobody's going to change something on the basis of our antipathy. We have to find some way to speak to each other again.